It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett makes the case that poverty in his city is an issue for the rest of us.
First, a look at video games and the U.S. military. Our next guest looks at the ways the military uses video game technology to recruit and train troops.
Corey Mead is with us. He's assistant professor of English at Root College in New York. His new book is Warplay: Video Games and the Future of Armed Conflict. He's a UW grad, by the way. Corey, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And welcome back to Wisconsin.
Yeah, I know. It's great.
So why does an English professor tackle video games in the military?
Well, it started at Wisconsin, actually. There's a group of great folks over in the education department who are studying. They're literacy specialists, which is what I was, but they're studying the way in which video games represent a new form of literacy and sort of studying the why of why kids will, you know, spend 60 hours playing these extremely difficult video games, the sort of, you know, frustratingly pleasurable video games, but they won't spend 5 minutes reading a book, you know. So what is it about the learning principles in video games? And I thought that was interesting just because I was trying to relate to my students, kind of find out the kinds of the things that motivated them. And then, you know, when I found out the political aspect that the military was, you know, light years ahead in sort of adopting this and exploiting this technology for learning purposes, I just wanted to learn more. And that's what pushed me on that road.
Well, let's dive in. The military, as you write, does a lot of things with video games and simulations.
Yeah.
What are, starting with maybe the obvious, combat training, how does the military use video games to train people for combat?
For combat, one of the most common ways they're doing it today is through these massively multiplayer online games. They'll have, say, like 100 soldiers in a room, and they'll each have their own computer, but they're all networked, and they'll be playing what looks like a first-person shooter video game. And you know, the commander will be in the other room sort of guiding the action. And so they'll be taking them through the actual terrain that they're going to be deploying to in Afghanistan. And so they get the sense both of the feel of the place where they're actually going, but they're also training more for you know, tactical knowledge. So that's the most obvious form that jumps out at people. That's just one of the many ways they're using games.
So probably a lot of the soldiers playing these games may have played a video game, Call of Duty or Medal of Honor, at home. Are they in for a rude surprise when they come to the simulators the Army uses?
Well, it causes a lot of problems for the trainers because the people out of, you know, from what they told me, out of the 100 people or so in a room, maybe 20 will be pretty experienced gamers or hardcore gamers. And so what those people do when they jump on the training game is right away they start doing what they do in a commercial video game, which is to figure out how to break the system. So they turn around and see if they can shoot their commander, and they do whatever they can to unlock the secrets of the sim, which is not the point of the training for the commanders, right? So you've got that going on one end. On the other end are the people who spend the entire training session trying to figure out how to work the keyboard because they're not familiar with games. So, you know, much of the training session is simply getting people to acknowledge it as a training session or get them up to speed to be able to participate.
Well, you mentioned, I think, one of the instructors, a drill sergeant, saying a big surprise to people experienced with his games is when they die.
Yes. That's, you know, he said that for a lot of the troops that do train on this, it's the first time they realize that they might die because they're used to these games, the commercial games, where if they die, they just reboot their avatar, and that doesn't happen in these games. If you die, if you sit down, you're out, and that's really frustrating for people, but it's also a real learning experience.
Does that get people to stop and think about the enormity of what they're going into, if they haven't already?
That's what the trainer said, yeah. You know, you have to talk to the soldiers themselves more about it. But I think it's the fact of the ways in which what they're bringing in terms of their knowledge of battle from their previous commercial video game use doesn't translate in the way that they imagine that it will.
The military has been at the cutting edge, you mentioned this, of video games. A lot of what came to be commercial video game technology started in the military. Talk about some of that history.
Well, the architecture itself, the technological architecture, is built on military-funded projects. And we can go back before that, and, you know, computers in general are built on military, you know, funded projects. The game industry and the first games were almost a happy or certainly an unexpected offshoot of computer engineering graduate students who were getting funded for other purposes and kind of in their spare time for fun built what was the first video game, this thing called Space War, which just came out of their love for science fiction. So essentially you had these MIT graduate students trying to entertain themselves in their off hours building what became the first game and working on the technology that became what the entire commercial game industry grew out of.
Is there a sense, is it an agreed thing in the military that training on these simulators, training in these game worlds, actually helps prepare troops for what they would encounter in a real deployment?
It's become more accepted now. It's been a long, for many years, sort of as, with the start of this more advanced kind of game-based training, it was really a few people, innovators within the military, who were pushing for this kind of thing. And they were facing resistance from the colonels and the generals who were just put off by the idea of using anything that was considered a game, right? They thought it was ridiculous. But a lot of the people, 12 years ago or 13 years ago when the war in Afghanistan started that were lower then are now the colonels themselves, right? And so there's a greater acceptance of what they think it can do.
And then more maybe controversially, you talk about how the military uses games for recruitment. They put the games out there, some of the, not the full simulations, I guess. What are they doing, and is it an effective tool?
The first game they developed for that was this game called America's Army, which first came out in 2002 and keeps being updated with new versions. Was extremely effective when it came out. The idea behind it was, it was actually the Army's sort of top economist that came up with this idea. And the idea was, they look at it as getting the Army brand out there, right? And, he uses phrases like they were competing for youth mind share with other possible jobs. And so the idea was to get kids when they were 12 or 13 and get this game directly to them without it being filtered through any other, what he calls mediators, without being filtered through, television or movies, so that he could get what he called the Army brand directly to these 12 and 13-year-olds and get them to start considering a career in the military, because he says, well, by the time they're 17, it's too late. You've lost them.
And America's Army isn't just America's Army anymore, right? Other countries have taken this
out. Yeah, it's been hugely popular around the world, absolutely. And in fact, the sort of blowback factor of that is that now other countries are using games modeled on America's Army to do their own form of recruiting. China is the most prominent example of that. They have a new game, and with the irony being that the enemy in the Chinese version of the game is the United States military.
And it's always, they only fight against American soldiers.
Exactly.
A bit ominous. Well, on a different note, we've talked about some of the combat simulators. That's not all they're doing with video games. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. There are, I don't know if you'd call them games, but computer simulations. How do they use these things to help treat PTSD?
So the most popular one for PTSD is called Virtual Iraq / Virtual Afghanistan, just depending on where you were deployed. And basically, you sit at a table, there's two chairs, you're in one, and you're wearing a virtual reality helmet. And there's in front of you, there's a computer with the imagery is taken from a video game called Full Spectrum Warrior that Army developed. And the game is being programmed by your therapist who's sitting right next to you according to some of the stuff that relates to your traumatizing experience. And basically, over the course of several weeks and months, you are taken through your traumatizing experience again and again. You're talking through it with the therapist next to you, and each time they're adding more and more detail in and trying to bring you to a greater point of stress so that eventually you're not dulled to the experience, but you stop being afraid of getting through the experience. You realize that you're going to get through each traumatizing event, right? And so in that sense, you lose the fear of having that memory again, that experience. And it's really an advanced version of talk therapy, where the visualization that you might do in regular therapy is enhanced by this, 3D by the virtual reality technology and everything else. And I tried it. It's pretty powerful. And I wasn't even coming from a place of obviously having been traumatized in war.
And then other games, simulations helping make the transition to civilian life, where you have, remind me if I read this right, you have choices of how you interact with your spouse or whether you seek help for this issue or other.
Yeah, so there's a ton of issues with reintegration that they're finding, and the game, especially this company called Will Interactive in Maryland, is working to to address all different kinds of reintegration issues. So some of it's like blended families, because there's so many divorces going on during deployment. So when you come back, if you blend your families, or any other number of games. And there's other games that are just being developed simply for the idea of getting soldiers to recognize the fact that maybe they are in need of some help. And so sort of gently saying, if you need help, here are some resources you can turn to. You know, if you're feeling these symptoms, you might want to think about seeking some assistance.
Corey Mead is with us. We're talking about his new book, War Play, Video Games and the Future of Armed Conflict.
And we want to hear from you on this one. Were you or are you in the military? Have you trained with the kind of simulations our guest is talking about? And what do you make of how the military is increasingly using video games? You can call us 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on our Facebook page. It's Central Time on WPR.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Corey Mead is with us. His new book is War Play, Video Games and the Future of Armed Conflict.
And you can join the conversation about the military's use of video games and simulations to recruit and train troops. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to the phones now. We have Joanne in Milwaukee. Joanne, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Did you have a question for our guest?
My question is, he was explaining how the video games are being used for people who are deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that it seems to be working well. What about same sort of use for PTSD victims of Vietnam? Some of those men have been suffering for 40 years, and perhaps they could benefit from this too.
Joanne,
and
thanks.
I'll say the answer will be here.
That's an interesting question. Corey, are they spinning it off from the Army maybe to VA hospitals to treat Vietnam-era veterans?
Well, it's funny because Virtual Iraq and Virtual Afghanistan, which I mentioned, were built off of this game called Virtual Vietnam, which was developed for that very purpose, to help Vietnam veterans. But it never really got taken. Like, they did some initial brief studies, and it seemed to be doing well. They got positive results, and then it just kind of died. So at this stage, the game, you know, getting the VAs to adopt Virtual Iraq and Virtual Afghanistan has been much more the push than reaching back to the Vietnam era. But there was this very promising game that just sort of was let go. So I guess that might tell you something about the attitude toward the treatment of vets. I'm not sure.
Or was it an attitude toward, as you mentioned earlier, not taking the idea of a game, in quotes, seriously?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and funding issues, too. I mean, that's, you know, especially when it comes to the VA. Anyway, it's all driven by economics. And so, you know, the only reason that games now are being accepted to the extent that they are is because they're economically feasible. Before computing power was as cheap as it became sort of in the mid to late 1990s, you know, there wasn't the wide use of it simply because they didn't consider it affordable. Although it's ironic when you compare it to a large weapon system, of course.
Thanks for the call, Joanne. We've got Sam with us now in Appleton. Sam, hi.
Hey, Corey, wanted to thank you for great class at UW-Madison.
Is this Sam Radford?
201. Yep, Sam Radford.
Hey, man,
a lot of fun in
doing
that class. And my question was, is it just the Army using these simulators, or is it other branches of the military as well?
Well, first of all, I should say that Sam Radford was obviously the worst student I ever had. no, it's all the branches are using the military. The Army has been way in the lead of using it. But the other branches are catching up.
Thanks a lot for the call, Sam. Hope you did well in Corey's class.
No, he got an F.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, now we know. It's out there.
No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I wanted to talk maybe about some of the more controversial elements of some of this. There's concern outside of the military, in the civilian world, about people playing military-themed video games, computer
right.
games, maybe being desensitized to violence. Is there concern within the armed forces or maybe from outside the armed forces that this is in some way desensitizing our troops?
I mean, I've seen a lot of concern outside the armed forces. Absolutely. That's been a big object of concern in the media and elsewhere. Within the armed forces, it's not the concern, because what they want from people who play video games, and the reason they like people that play video games, is because they think, or, you know, and research shows this too, video games, the complex ones, they give you the ability to sort of channel switch and process enormous amounts of data being thrown at you. And they think that that translates well into the modern battlefield today, where it is chaotic and there are, you know, several different channels of information coming at you. So people that have the ability to sort of work through that and sort out the important bits from the jumble are the kinds of people they want to have.
And speaking of the other branches of the military, this is a high-tech world. A lot of what happens in the armed forces isn't an infantry platoon on the battlefield. What are some of the higher-tech simulations that they're using?
The highest, you know, within the simulations they've been using, the high-tech questions are more about how realistic can we get it, and what's the amount of realism we need to make this an effective training tool, right? So it's issues of what they call scalability when it comes to the games. So how realistic does the explosion need to be to get you to react in the way that you might react on the battlefield to an explosion, right? And so the higher tech applications become with more and more fidelity in terms of the visuals.
But as opposed to the infantry simulations you're talking about, how about helicopters, planes, ships, that sort of thing? Are we seeing a lot of simulations?
Definitely all those. I don't know if they're any more technologically complex. I would say the most technologically complex stuff they're doing is when they're combining the virtual with the live in large what are called shoot houses. So you're actually inside like a warehouse with digital flats around you where images are being projected. So it's this combination of the two that's their ultimate, what they want for training. That's what the military would love. I mean, because of reasons of space and money, they're only going to get that on a limited basis, but that's the ideal.
Now, taking it back to where you started coming from, you found that the technologies and the methods being used in the military are inspiring and spinning off into use in schools. What kind of spinoffs are you seeing there?
Well, there was the fact that just, and we can take this back further, that educational technology in general the military has been the biggest funder of it for the past several decades. And so there have been a lot of applications developed for the military that have been spun off into the schools. In terms of how to use the video games, it's the very fact of treating games in a serious way in the first place and looking at what the learning principles behind games are that are being adapted by the schools. There's also ways in which the military is actually trying to get its recruiting games into the schools for recruitment purposes. That's happened with America's Army, and that's happening now with some of the cyber stuff. That it's, again, this issue of how do we get the Army brand in front of kids who are 12 and 13. So if we want them to go into cyber occupations and cyber defense and security, they might come to us instead of going to whatever, you know, Silicon Valley is paying for the same skills. It's obviously a battle that's a difficult one for them to win because Silicon Valley can pay salaries that the Army can't. But it's the sort of process that happened 12 years ago all over again, but not with cyber.
So for non-military teaching applications in schools, what are some of the programs you're seeing spring up, maybe inspired by the technology, inspired by what we learned about learning from video games in the military, and being learned to use to teach non-military topics in schools?
I think the games that are the most effective they've found so far are games where it's not about the content per se, right? Not a game to teach you facts and figures per se, but games that let you take on the persona of whatever you're trying to learn about. So a biology game, you take on the avatar of a biologist, and the idea is to get you to learn how to think like whatever that particular individual is. So that's been more effective. So the games that have been in the sort of content-based disciplines like history, a really good early game for teaching that was this game called Civilization, where you actually have to build a civilization. Or another good place has been urban planning, where you actually are doing, you know, building things. Because, again, these require you to take on the roles of a doer, not just someone who's sitting there getting this information kind of dumbed down your throat that you have to then regurgitate later.
And that's back to the idea that you started the show off with, how to get kids excited and interested in learning something if we can't get them to crack a book for an hour.
Right.
So, Corey, very interesting stuff. Thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was Corey Mead. His new book is Warplay, Video Games and the Future of Armed Conflict. Well, do you see applications for this in the classroom or the military? You can post on the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR. Or was there a video game, a computer game that got you or your kid interested in learning more about a subject and thinking like the ruler of a civilization. And that's what led me to pull my first all-nighters ever, I think, was when the Civilization computer game came out.
The first of many, I'm sure.
Yeah. Unfortunately, very few of them were actually academically oriented, mostly computer game oriented.
Well, coming up next, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett joins us after the news to make the case that poverty in Milwaukee, it's an issue for all of us. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Census data is out, and it places Milwaukee as one of the most impoverished big cities in the country, with nearly a third of the city living in poverty in 2012.
Some people respond thinking it's a Milwaukee problem, but Mayor Tom Barrett disagrees. He says it's a regional problem that needs a regional solution. He's here with us now to talk about why that is. Mayor Barrett, welcome to the show.
It's great to be joining you.
What do you make of the new census numbers about poverty in Milwaukee and the area?
Well, sadly, it's not shocking, and it shows why we have committed ourselves in the last 9 years to a very proactive approach in working with the private sector to create jobs near neighborhoods where they're needed most. Neighborhoods like the Menominee Valley, our Reed Street Yards, which is on the near south side, and the 30th Street Industrial Quarter, because we have lost a lot of jobs. And in the manufacturing downturn of the 80s and 90s, we lost many jobs. And, of course, in the Great Recession, those citizens and residents who had the lowest incomes were hit the hardest. So we understand that because of housing patterns, because of transportation patterns, because of employment patterns, that the majority of low-income people in southeastern Wisconsin are located within the city of Milwaukee, we've got some special challenges.
You call it a regional problem. Why is that?
Well, what was interesting is if you look at this data and other data that's just come out that's similar in nature, the city of Milwaukee has approximately 29.5% of its residents living in poverty, which puts us as the city with the ninth highest percentage of people living in poverty. In sharp contrast, if you look at our suburban friends, they've got the third lowest percentage of people living in poverty. And even more striking, and I just saw an analysis that did this, if you do the ratios, if you compare the two ratios, southeastern Wisconsin, the Milwaukee metropolitan area is the only area where that factor is greater than four. In other words, what we have here is we have huge economic segregation that's occurring in this metropolitan area with low-income people located substantially and significantly in the central city, in the city proper itself. And we can draw lines and we can have different borders, but the fact is that this is something that has an impact on the entire region.
What kind of solutions would you like to see at a regional level to tackle poverty in Milwaukee?
Well, again, I just want your listeners to know that at the city level, we are extremely proactive. I think that's the first place it has to be. And I've already mentioned the Menominee Valley, the Reed Street Yards, the 30th Street Industrial Quarter. But there are other places where we're working at the city level. We're working to reduce teen pregnancy. We're working to do what we can for job readiness through workforce development. And obviously, we're working to have safer neighborhoods. That has an impact on this as well. However, with the housing patterns that you have in southeastern Wisconsin, with the lack of public transportation to jobs that are located outside of Milwaukee County, I don't think that these numbers are shocking. And when I say they're not shocking, they're shocking in the sense that they're the worst numbers in the country in terms of this economic segregation. But I don't see how people can be surprised because the strategy of separating low-income people from middle-income and upper-income people has been a strategy that's been in place for decades here.
There are probably people listening in the suburban area around Milwaukee or beyond thinking why is this my problem? We're doing okay here. Why should I worry about lower income people over in Milwaukee? How would you make that case to them?
Well, frankly, I could make the same case if I weren't the mayor in the neighborhood that I live in. I live in a nice middle class neighborhood, and I could say, well, this isn't my problem. These are poor people who live on the other side of the park, or on the other side of the tracks, or on the other side of the county divide. And we can always find ways to separate each other. But the strength of this region is going to be dependent, I think, in the long run, based on not only how well the wealthiest people do, but how well middle-class people do and how well low-income people do. And we're seeing signs of this nationally, because nationally what you're seeing is over the last 10 years in the 50 largest metropolitan areas in the country, the share of the population increase was about 10% in the cities, but the share of people living below the poverty level raised about 25%. So cities are increasingly asked to bear this social burden. And again, you do not want to create a situation where your central business area, your central city, and when I say central city, I mean the city proper, bears this load. And that's why we've been saying, look, of course we should have highway construction, but you have to have mass transit alternatives. Of course there should be housing development, but you have to have workforce housing close to where the workforce needs to be, particularly in those areas where there's not mass transit. If we don't do that, I think that's going to hamper this region economically.
Isn't one of the obstacles that if somebody in one of these low-income areas does okay, they make money, they get a good job, one of the first things they want to do is to move into a middle-class area, whether within the city or one of the suburbs? How do you contest that kind of maybe natural urge?
Well, that's the American way. And I don't argue with that. I think that that's something that people obviously are interested in doing. And I think everybody wants to keep up with the Joneses, and everybody wants to get ahead of the Joneses. But as a region, we have to be mindful of the challenges that occur here. And again, government policies, real estate policies, lending policies have led to a situation where the majority of people who are low income are concentrated in a geographic area that puts tremendous stresses on other aspects of this metropolitan area. So we talk about regional assets all the time, but seldom do we hear people talk about regional responsibilities. And to me, those are flip sides of the same record album.
One solution you mentioned was the idea of better regional public transportation. That can be a tall order politically. There have been regional transportation associations brought up and shot down around the state. Do you think something like that can happen, where you and your neighbors work together and build up a regional public transit system?
Well, look, I wasn't born on a turnip truck, and not only is this difficult, I realize that a lot of political hay can be made in opposing public transportation, particularly opposing public transportation that gets low-income workers out of low-income neighborhoods into other parts of this metropolitan area. I know that politically that people have staked their career on making sure that doesn't happen. The question is that the right thing? I don't think it is.
And then you mentioned the decline in manufacturing jobs, and it seems like the economic climate is such that they're not going to come back and be the main solution. What kind of sectors do you see driving recovery in Milwaukee and the region, and maybe giving jobs to the people, that 29% of people in Milwaukee living in poverty?
Well, I don't sell manufacturing short. Certainly this isn't 1950 or 1960, but we still have a relatively high percentage of people who work in the manufacturing sector when we compare it to other regions in the country. So that is still a significant area, I think, for potential growth for jobs. And that's why I've created my Mayor's Manufacturing Initiative, because one of the challenges and one of the frustrations I've encountered is people who go through a training program, and then there's no job. And then I talk to employers who hire people from a training program, and they say, well, they're not qualified to do the jobs that they have. So what we've worked to do, working through our workforce development agency and the technical college, is to cut out the middleman. In other words, what we've done is we found employers who have actual jobs and said, look, we will get the people, we will help pay for the training for those specific jobs. In exchange, you hire them. Cuts out the middleman. They know they're getting people who are getting trained, and they're getting trained for real-world jobs. The people going through the programs know that at the end of this tunnel, there's going to be light. There is going to be a job. And so it's not like a training program where they feel like they've gotten a diploma at the end, but there's no job. We're trying to actually match the jobs up with the people. And we have found that that has been more successful.
Is it frustrating, in closing, to be the mayor of Milwaukee and see it show up time after time on the list of among the more poverty-stricken nations in the country?
Well, I love being the mayor of Milwaukee, but it certainly is frustrating to see what I perceive as a problem that we could address more readily if there was more cooperation and if there was more of an understanding that this isn't the problem that lies on one side of the tracks or the other side of the tracks, that we're all in this together.
Mayor Barrett, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you very much.
That was Tom Barrett, mayor of Milwaukee.
I'm Veronica Rickards.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Well, the weather's starting to turn a bit colder around Wisconsin, which means one thing in that kitchen, comfort food.
For our Food Friday segment this week, we're talking to the guys from Wisconsin Foodie about their favorite mac and cheese recipes and some other comfort foods to help us forget about the impending doom of winter.
Joining us now are Arthur Ersing, creator and executive producer of Wisconsin Foodie, and Kyle Cherik, host of Wisconsin Foodie. Hi, guys.
Hello.
So you guys have mac and cheese on your minds. Kyle, tell us what's got you thinking about macaroni and cheese right now.
Oh, well, judging this contest that's coming up, the I guess sort of a smackdown where a myriad of local chefs get to come in with literally no boundaries, as I was reading, and we're going to sample out some mac and cheese and declare the best presented that day. And so I've been holding off on it for about a week, which is hard to do, but you know, you want to have a clean palate or something like that. Because you never know what the onslaught's going to be.
Oh, I know. And Arthur, you know, what is it about macaroni and cheese, do you think, that makes it such good comfort food, especially now that it's getting a little nippy?
Well, I think, you know, you got to look at the cheese. You got to look at the, you know, just that kind of that texture, the melty, the hearty. It just, like, reminds us of our childhood and of home. And you know, where else would you rather be on a nice, cool fall day than sitting at home eating some mac and cheese?
The nice thing about mac and cheese is that it's one of these dishes that you can really put your own stamp on. It's sort of a blank slate. You need the noodles. You probably need some kind of cheese, although I've seen vegan versions of it. But beyond that, you can get really kind of creative with it. Kyle, what have you seen done with mac and cheese that gets it kind of jiggy?
Well, my favorite, you know, sort of mac and cheese take me back moment, I actually had the dish. I don't want to disclose where, but it took me back to this great rosemary mac and cheese that the Social, when it was still open here in Milwaukee, this tiny place, and the chef who had trained under Sanford D'Amato, Chris Hattali, made it right there in front of you because it was this super small place. You sat at what was originally the bar, and he grilled it and finished it off right in front of you, and it had this terrific, amazing herbal, slightly smoky, creamy, perfect every time. It was the most sublime mac and cheese I'd ever had to that point in my entire life. And he made it from scratch with the exception of the pasta right there in front of you. And so I guess in my heart and on my palate, I kind of dare anybody whenever they say, oh, I've got great mac and cheese, to get that good, to come to that level.
You will see on September 29th with this, the mac and cheese takedown, because I think you'll be sampling over 50 different mac and cheeses. So that may you may find a better mac and cheese out there.
Yeah, use the word sublime. The bar is pretty high there for that one.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, a great dish is a great dish. I don't know what more. We like to write and think about these things, but sometimes it's those opening notes of think of a great Gershwin melody or something like that, where you know it instantly, and more notes or less notes would be too many or not enough. It's just perfect.
So it seems like in general there are two ways you can do mac and cheese, you know, besides all of the variations, but you can do it the saucy way, where it's sort of like your craft, but, you know, you don't have to bake it. And then there's the baked kind.
That's not mac and cheese. I'm sorry. That's
you're drawing the line right there.
Yeah, that and vegan mac and cheese. I mean, God bless anybody that wants to pursue the lifestyle of being a vegan. I think it's great, but that's not mac and cheese.
Well, do you have a preference as far as baked versus the saucy kind?
Well, naturally saucy. It goes with my personality. Arthur's the real cheese aficionado, though. I want to hear him.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's talk about cheeses, because that's obviously, you know, the first thing you need in a good mac and cheese. Arthur, what do you prefer when it comes to cheeses and mac and cheese?
Well, I think we're, you know, obviously we're pretty blessed here in Wisconsin with having, you know, just the kind of variety and abundance of amazing world quality cheeses, right in our back door. So, there's one mac and cheese recipe that we had on our show, years and years ago with, Tori Miller was on, and he was a fresh faced Mohawked, younger gentleman. And, he was cooking on our show, and he created a double cut pork chop with a mac and cheese. And the mac and cheese was, you know, basically these large shells, and he reduced, white wine, and he used, you know, almost a whole pack of the cold pack cheese, and then shredded some, Car Valley, Mammoth cheddar, as well as some, Bluemont Dairy, bandage cheddar into the mac and cheese. Now that, like, you know, not everybody, there's nobody in the world that can mimic those types of cheeses in this mac and cheese. And that makes that dish one of my favorite mac and cheeses out there. And we have, you know, what I'm going to do is I went back into our vault of videos, and I found the video, and I'm going to post it on the front page of our website. So if people are interested in seeing the, you know, how he makes his mac and cheese, they can check that recipe out on our website.
That's so interesting.
For the record, if I had could try that, that might usurp the old social mac and cheese, but I wasn't lucky enough to have that. I'll have to talk to Tori about that.
But instead of baking it, you know, it's kind of saucy. Instead of baking it, though, he throws some toasted panko breadcrumbs on the top, so it has that kind of like crunchy, you know, texture to it.
I like that he added the cold pack cheese with these very high end cheeses, bandaged cheddar and mammoth cheddar.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really a mixture of things. So what did that do to the taste? I'm curious.
Oh, I mean, it's, you know, it's hard to explain. It's basically, you know, like eating happiness.
That doesn't sound bad at all.
It's curious how some of the most basic peasant dishes, for lack of a better term, can be innovated into something that's really, really dynamic at the hands of a great chef. You know, I mean, Kraft just brings it down way too many levels, but the original mac and cheese is a very simple dish. But then at the hands of Tori, he knows what to do with it. You take it to a different level, but it's still a peasant dish, essentially.
Well, so now is the time of year when root veggies are starting to be more abundant, things like squash. Do you think those lend themselves well to mac and cheese, Kyle?
I do. They're kind of, for me, it's a textural thing. I mean, I'm a big roaster of all of those root vegetables and the squashes and things like that. Basically, that takes over for all the green things that are so abundant from our garden in the summer. But I probably wouldn't put the two next to each other, essentially. If I was doing mac and cheese at home, we'll do a protein or something a little bit more rustic to stand up against that creaminess.
Such as? Like a bacon or
ham? No, I would. Everyone that's been following me lately knows that I'm huge on lamb and or a pork roast or a great lamb chop. Pork chop cut or a lamb chop. And you know the thing about fall cooking that I always have to guard against is having something. This sounds funny, but that I can really chew, because between the mac and cheeses and the amazing stews and all of those things that you roast to get all the goodness and so forth out of them, it softens them down like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So I find myself by November basically just craving some really crunchy bread.
So you want something with a little tooth in it.
Yeah, exactly. One of my favorite things in the fall, actually, is this great dessert that George Washington, apparently I found online, really loved, which is using a pie pumpkin and scooping it out and then putting in a very simple custard recipe inside. And my sister-in-law actually made it for Thanksgiving a couple of years ago. And you put the whole thing in the oven for like 4 or 5 hours, and it slowly roasts and the two come together. And it is one of the most delicious, incredible. And then you just carve right into it and serve the custard out. It's so amazing.
Oh, that doesn't sound like so you turn away at your dinner table. That sounds fantastic. I've had custards baked in the miniature pumpkins, and they're pretty great vessels just for that kind of thing, too. Well, as we get toward the end of our time together, what other fall comfort foods, Arthur, are you getting psyched about right now?
I'm just excited about, you know, this is, you know, being a vegetarian, this is like the glory time right now at the farmer's markets. You have, you know, the tomatoes are there. Everything is kind of just total abundance. So where I've been going lately, what I've been really trying to master is canning all this great food. You know, we take part in a CSA here in you know, Springdale Farms, and we get, you know, a box of vegetables each week. And it's just, you know, I want to try to, you know, take all of that great fresh food and the stuff that I can't eat that whole week or my family can't eat, I'm trying to figure out how to preserve it. So I've been making tomato sauces, salsas, and, you know, just trying to keep that stuff so in the middle of winter I can, you know, still be eating delicious local food. That's, if not total fresh, it's pretty close.
And Kyle, in the last 30 seconds here, what about you? What are you looking forward to besides mac and cheese?
Oh, that's so hard. I just basically, I can't get the menu flips that happen. I totally agree with Arthur. Any chef can cook fabulous things during the summer, some salt and butter, and great things are coming out of the ground. In fall, when the menu flips happen and the vegetables change and the proteins really come into their own, I do food tourism in a different way around the state because and in spring is when the chefs get most creative, and it's just exciting to have some of their dishes.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happily.
And Arthur, good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
We were talking to Arthur Ersin, creator and executive producer of Wisconsin Foodie, and Kyle Cherik, the host of Wisconsin Foodie.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll talk about how scarcity and the way we respond to it shapes our lives, our society, and our culture.
We'll also talk about the history of what's often called the most important meal of the day, breakfast.
And we'll talk about how a lot of us can be citizen scientists. We can help wildlife experts keep track of animal populations around Wisconsin.
That's all coming up Monday, right here on Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.